part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. The caste system was abolished in India's constitution in 1950, but it endures. There are 165 million untouchables in India today, but there is resistance. Our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine is Narendra Jadhav. He's written a memoir about his family's journey out of the caste system. The title, Untouchables, My Family's Triumphant Journey Out of the Caste System in Modern India. This is how the book begins. Every sixth human being in the world today is an Indian, and every sixth Indian is an erstwhile untouchable, a Dalit. Today there are 165 million Dalits, equal to more than half of the population of the United States, and they continue to suffer under India's 3,500-year-old caste system, which remains a stigma on humanity. However, Dalits are awakening. We are struggling against caste discrimination, illiteracy, and poverty. Our weapons are education, self-empowerment, and democracy. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Narendra Jadhav is an economist, writer, and public speaker. He is the principal advisor and chief economist for the Reserve Bank of India. He was born in Mumbai and makes his home there today. He studied economics at Mumbai University and Indiana University, where he earned his doctorate. The book Untouchables, My Family's Triumphant Journey Out of the Caste System in Modern India, was first published in India in 1993. It was a huge success. Now it's available in the U.S., published by Scribner. Narendra Jadhav, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
I'm delighted to be here on the afternoon show.
My pleasure to speak with you. What kind of a discussion has your book generated in India?
Oh, it has generated a lot of discussion in India. As you mentioned, the Marathi version, the local Indian language version, was published in 1993, and it has been a bestseller for all these years. The English version I wrote while I was working here in the United States, when I was working with the International Monetary Fund between the year 1998 and 2002, and that was when I wrote the English version. Mm. During all this period, there have been various discussions about this book. This book has now been, not only has it been a bestseller, but it is a prescribed reading at various levels, the high school and the college and at the university level. And outside the academia, there has been a lot of discussion about the rise of all this huge mass of humanity who is seeking dignity, and they are fighting for their rights to be treated as human beings and not like cats and dogs that they were treated as before the independence of my country.
Yeah. While it endures, the caste system was abolished when India became a republic in January of 1950.
Right.
Did that have any effect on the injustices untouchables suffer?
Well, absolutely. It has had a lot of effect. In fact, after abolishing untouchability, to practice untouchability is an offense, and it's punishable by law. So untouchability has stopped. What has happened is that while the brutal, inhuman form of caste discrimination that prevailed for a long time has gone, I feel that it still exists, but it exists now in a somewhat more sophisticated form. And in its more sophisticated form, it is in fact even more pernicious than what it was in the brute, obvious form. For example, at the worst of the caste system in India, my forefathers had to carry a clay pot around their neck so that their spit doesn't pollute the ground. Even had to kind of tie a broom around their vest to clean the ground that they walk on, and their touch was sacrilege. But that was the worst part. That is no longer there. After independence and after the abolishment of untouchability, that's all gone. But it would be foolhardy to assume that with that, the caste system is gone. Mm. It now resides in the mindset of people and has acquired a sophisticated dimension in which, as I said before, it's more pernicious than what it was earlier.
Yeah. So it's gone underground, so to speak.
It has gone underground, yes.
Yeah.
It's there in the mindset now. So it comes out in a subtle manner.
So because it's in the mindset, that's why it endures.
Right. Yeah. You see, in India, even by name, you can find out the caste. And what happens is that whenever we meet each other, when people meet each other, they ask obvious questions about the name and where are you from. And the idea is, you know, all those questions actually lead to one single question: what is your caste? But, you know, you don't ask anybody a caste outright, but you go all the way around and ask several questions. But the essence of that is, what is your caste? Mm. Once we know what is the caste of the other person, you know where to place him in your scheme of things and how to deal with that person. Mm. This is really unfortunate, but that is true.
Yeah. Now, how does this affect you and your family?
Well, it does affect my family, and it has affected. What happens is, you know, they are treated, you know, all Dalits, including my family and everybody, they were treated subhuman, and they were treated worse than cats and dogs. So at various points, it has affected my family. For example, my grandfather or my forefathers, they had to go through all this brutal caste discrimination. My father himself was subject to many of caste discrimination. The many incidents were there about the caste discrimination. In my time, when I was a child, I suffered not in the brutal form, but in a sophisticated form. To give you an example, now when I went to school, high school, there is an affirmative action program for Dalits, which gives certain amount of concessions in the school fees. It gives a certain amount of reservation in jobs at entry point and so on. Now, when I was in the school, every now and then, the class teacher will, while taking a roll call, will mention my name, asking for fees, and then plead as if he is making a mistake, and then they'll say, oh, I forgot, you are a son-in-law of the government. You know, so that was when I came to realize that I'm a Dalit, and that I'm somewhat different from others,
yeah.
Because I was treated differently.
Yeah.
You know, so in various forms, these things are imposed on your mind. Even my daughter, who is now studying in the U.S., when she was in the high school, in the class, suddenly one day a teacher asked her, are you the daughter of the famous Dalit scholar, Narendra Jadhav?
Right.
And she was very happy because her father was recognized. But at the same time, when she came home, she said, why did she call you a Dalit scholar? We are Dalits and you are a scholar. But why create this new caste called Dalit scholar?
Yeah.
So it's the way you're treated.
Well, mm-hmm. We certainly do that in this country. You're a woman writer or an African-American writer.
Right.
Not,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Not.
Yeah. No, I believe that the glass walls are same everywhere. The purpose, the content may be different, but the discrimination of one group against the other, and to maintain hegemony of one group doing all kinds of things, it's something which is common everywhere. The only thing different about the Indian caste system is that it is a very well-managed scam going on for the last 2,000 years or more. It is a very complicated web that has been created. And until my father's generation, all of them were told that you have to do these demeaning tasks in this birth because of what your misdeeds were in your previous birth. And you must do the job which is ordained by the caste system in this birth, in this world, and that will give you nirvana in the sense that in the next birth, you will be better placed if you do your job dutifully now. I think this is like a huge dose of opium that was given to all these people, and they would not revolt because they blamed, they were ignorant, they were illiterate, and they blamed all that was happening to them, their plight, was blamed on their misdeeds in the previous births. And they were told not to challenge the existing system because if they don't challenge and if they do their job ordained, decided by the caste dutifully, then next birth they will come out smelling roses. Who has seen the next birth and who knows about the previous birth? The point here is that they were told not to challenge the system. And this is how the big scam has been going on for several thousand years.
Yeah. Now, today, how do Hindu religious leaders deal with these issues?
Well, religious leaders deal... You see, what has happened is that Dalits have numbers. Remember, we are a parliamentary democracy. Mm-hmm. In a democratic system, the so-called high born, so-called high caste, they don't have numbers with them. So the whole society, I think, let's understand this division in the Indian system before we deal with how the political or religious leaders are handling mm-hmm. the situation. You know, it would be interesting for people to understand, because I realize that very little is known. You know, the whole Indian society was divided into four broad categories. One first category, the topmost category, was those who had qualities of head, intelligent people. Now, they were given a particular kind of job, the job of the priest for learning and preaching. The second group was the group of people who were not necessarily very intelligent, but those who were rugged and tough, and they were given the warrior kind of, they were called the warrior class. Then the third group was those people who were street smart. And the fourth group was those who are good for nothing, and they were the service class, servants class. And untouchables were even below that fourth class. Now, in terms of numbers, the majority is with the fourth class and the underclass, which are untouchables. Numbers are with them. And these four are the four were the broad classes. They were further slivered into several thousand castes and subcastes and sub-subcastes and a very, very intricate, complicated design created to maintain the hegemony of a small ruling class. Whatever happened to the lives of anybody, you know, if a child is born, you have to pay money to the high caste. If there is a marriage in the family, you have to pay the money to the high caste. If somebody dies in your family, you have to pay money to the high caste. So, you know, the whole system was a big kind of scam which went on for a long time. Now, how are the religious leaders handling it? Religious leaders are handling it, you know, they have to maintain balance. And what they try to do is to appease to this large group of people. And they basically are interested in perpetuating the system. You know, there was a very, very interesting debate on this issue between two of our founding fathers of my nation. One was Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Baba Saheb Ambedkar. Dr. Baba Saheb Ambedkar was an untouchable who became savior for all of us, including my father, you know, millions of people. He was the one who became the savior. And there was a debate between these two founding fathers where Mahatma Gandhi, who was a, you know, noble soul, he was interested in perpetuating the system. So he defended this fourfold classification, saying that this is nothing but division of labor. It was Dr. Ambedkar who pointed out that this was not simply the division of labor. Division of labor is a time-honored principle in economics. There's nothing wrong with it. But what we had in our system was superimposed on the division of labor was division of laborers. So a son of a highborn, even if he was a useless vagabond, nobody deprived him of his priesthood. He kept doing what he was supposed to be doing by the caste. Whereas a son of a Dalit or an untouchable, no matter how intelligent he was, how gifted he or she was, they were never given the job of a priest. They were confined to a demeaning, lowly kind of duties assigned to them by their caste. This was unnatural. This was inhuman. And I dare say that it is because that these people were never allowed to realize their own potential. The country has lost out on economic growth over a period of time. That's what I feel. And the religious leaders have generally been perpetuating this. In fact, I remember one of the big religious leaders in India saying that even in blood, he said, there are four different groups. The implication is that the fourfold stratification of population is as natural as the fourfold stratification of different blood groups. Nothing can be misleading than this. But this is going on, but people are coming out of it. I think Dalits are awakening. They are realizing that education is the only panacea for their upliftment, and they are going for it, inspired by Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar.
Yeah. The Indian economy has boomed in recent years.
Absolutely.
Has this presented Dalits with new opportunities?
Absolutely, it has. It has presented Dalits with new opportunities. In fact, in the last, you see, we started our economic reforms in 1991, and in the last 13 years, Indian economy has come up very well, and it's a very sound, vibrant economy, and the confidence that the rest of the world has in the future of India is unprecedented. Even more importantly, the confidence that the Indians have about themselves is to be seen to be believed. Remember that for a very long time, we were growing at the rate of only 3.5% per year, and the population was growing at the rate of 2.2%, which means that our standard of living was growing at the rate of only 1.3% per year. At that measly rate, it would have taken us 58 long years to double our per capita income. That is all gone now. The Indian economy is today among the fastest growing countries in the world. And at the rate at which we are growing, we can double our per capita income in 15 to 18 years. This change has also meant a lot of opportunities to Dalits, for everybody. I mean, this poses both the opportunities as well as challenges. I think the whole Indian economy has become very competitive. And in that competitive spirit, a lot of people are coming up. And the accent now is on inclusive growth. Those like untouchables who are outside the periphery, outside the mainstream, are joining the mainstream and contributing to economic growth and development. I'm very happy to tell you that in India today, there is nothing short of a kind of silent revolution taking place. You know, in every walk of life, from, say, painting to sculptures to even neurosurgery, you will find an erstwhile untouchable man or woman trying to carve out a place for himself or herself. I think this is harbinger. This is an indication. This is symptomatic of very good future. Admittedly, sure enough, there is very small minority which is coming forward. And there are a large number of people who are still lagging behind. But I think the process of change is taking place, and I think it is a very, very positive feature of the Indian economy, and this augurs very well about the future.
Yeah. Something that I have heard that I think is amazing and very interesting is that Indians who have come to the United States or have gone to the United Kingdom to make their life, they are now returning to India because they want to be a part of this.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. No. This is a reverse brain drain has started.
Right.
Remember, first of all, the common notion that people have that everybody who comes to USA or UK sticks around and doesn't go back is itself an exaggeration. That has never been 100% true. People like me, for example, when I came in the 80s for PhD here, I finished my PhD in 1986, and there were 15 job offers for me. But I turned all of them down, and within 1 week after finishing my education, I went back to my country. Because I believe, and many people like me believe, that there is no substitute whatsoever to two things, your parents and your motherland. So I went back, and there were many people going back. Now what has happened is that earlier, while significant proportion of people were getting settled here, today it's so much is happening in India that those who are settled here are wanting to go back. Today, a fresh MBA in India has 4 or 5 good job offers. 2 are from US, 1 is from Europe, and remaining 2 are from Indian. And there is at least 50% chance that he will take the Indian offer rather than the offer from the Americans. Mm. Or those who are already here in US are trying to go back to work in their company in US operating in India. So there is this going back. It is not an accident. I must mention this, Salas, that India has now emerged as recipient of the largest amount of migrant workers' remittances. In last 1 year alone, India received $23 billion from the Indians working abroad everywhere. This is because of the strong family connections, family ties that they have. This money is going back to India. And I think it is playing some important stabilizing role in India's economic growth and development.
Yeah. Well, speaking of family ties,
right,
we need to talk about your parents.
Absolutely.
Two remarkable people.
Thank you.
And and I want to relate a story that you tell in the book to our listeners.
Right.
And that is when you went back home after you earned your doctorate at Indiana.
Right.
You sat down with your father, and he asked you about just what it was you did and in your research. And you talked with him, and then his next question to you after was, what are you doing? His next question was, how will this help the common man?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You want me to tell that story, but you have mentioned the story. You know, when I went back, you know, my father and mother, you know, they were two very different people. My father was, he never went to school, but he was gifted and he had this touch of genius and he had seen the world and he had all kinds of experiences and he was man of the world and he had a vision given by Dr. Ambedkar. My mother was a simple person. You will find it very difficult to believe that my mother did not know that a country like United States of America exists. It's very hard to believe, I can imagine. But my father and mother both did not know that America exists. So they were living in their own world. Particularly my mother was very simple. Now, there was always a conflict because when I went back after my PhD, I used to work, any other researcher, a serious researcher. I work all the time, and she would wonder, and she could not fathom. So one day she came and told me that, why are you working so hard? They tell me that you went abroad. For her, abroad meant only United Kingdom. You went abroad and studied all these books, and now you have come back. Now you should take life easy. What is the point in burning yourself out? So she said, isn't that true that you became a doctor? So I said, yes. And then she wanted me to tell her about it. And I was trying to explain to her what doctorate is all about. And then my father takes over. Now, this is like a theater of absurd completely. One illiterate man is explaining to his illiterate wife what PhD is. But see how my father put it out. He said, well, it's very simple. This degree, he said, is like a driving license. You don't stop driving after you get driving license, do you? Your driving begins with the driving license. Now, you know, I believe me, I have stayed in the United States for 9 years, and I have had privilege of working with great scholars, but nobody has given me such a perfect perspective on what doctoral degree is all about. Now, how did this man know that degree is only a means to an end, and it is not an end in itself? I don't know, but he knew it. And the way he put it, I can't put it better than what he did. Today, if a young student comes to me and talks to me about doctorate, I tell them it is like a driving license. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. After you get the license, you've got to drive.
Absolutely. Your driving begins after with right. license. It doesn't yeah. end in license.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Narendra Jadhav. He's an economist, he's a writer, public speaker, he's principal advisor and chief economist for the Reserve Bank of India, and he's the author of Untouchables, My Family's Triumphant Journey Out of the Caste System in Modern India. So how did your father grow into the man he was, who was so determined to shape his own destiny and
right.
to see to it that his children got their driver's licenses?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's a long story, but just to tell you the highlights of the story, my father, Damu, came to Mumbai. You know, we all come, our family comes from a small village about 130 miles from Mumbai. And Mumbai is the capital of Maharashtra, which is a major province on the west coast of India. Now, my father came to Mumbai when he was 10 years old. 10-year-old Damu comes to Mumbai and explores life in Mumbai, and he even worked as an errand boy in a British family. That time, India was under the colonial rule. So he, as a little boy, worked as an errand boy. He worked with a British family and did all kinds of odd jobs and got experience in his life. Later on, when he was working with the railways, Indian railways, he lost that job, and it was the same time the turn came to my family for performing the so-called village duties. And these village duties were the duties assigned traditionally for thousands of years for my caste to perform, which involved working as a village servant in return for no money, but some award in terms of begging right. You know, that was supposed to be an award for those services. The whole thing was extremely demeaning. He was reluctant to go because when he was in Mumbai and when he grew up in Mumbai into a young man, he came in touch with Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, who, as I mentioned before, was the leader, the savior, and he was the one who taught millions of Dalits, untouchables, to demand a decent life, and that it was a matter of their right to have a decent life, and they could not be treated like cats and dogs. So he was the one who had inspired, Babasaheb Ambedkar was the one who had inspired this young Damu. But unfortunately, when he loses his job in Mumbai, somewhere in 1929 or 1930, around the Great Depression days, that was the time when the turn came on the family to perform the village duties. So much against his wishes, he goes back to village to perform the duties because his mother was insisting that we must follow the tradition. He goes there reluctantly and he's doing the village duties. And then incident takes place where his mettle is really tested, and he stands up against the police, against the authorities, and defies them and says that he will not do the village duties. He defies them. He's whipped for that, but he doesn't care for that. He stands up and realizes that he has to say no to the caste discrimination. So he stands up against the authorities. They beat him up. He runs away in the middle of night back to Mumbai, and then he begins his new life, and from there onwards, he never looked back. There he joins the movement, the social movement of Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, and then that changes his life. And he comes to realize later that education is the only panacea for upliftment of his family, like many others did. And then he puts all his children to the best possible schools. They were not great schools, but they were, as perceived by him at the time, the best possible mm-hmm. schools. And all of us did well. We are four brothers and two sisters, and all of us did very well. And we sort of brought his dreams to fruition. So it is a story of, But it's not the story of only rags to riches. You know, I have seen that many critiques talk about this story, about this man and his wife, and it's the story of the oppression and struggle against the caste system. I think this is more, this is not a story of self-pity. This is a story of self-realization.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a story about something going wrong and the injustice meted out to a family. This is a story about how a family led by one person like Damu, inspired by Dr. Ambedkar, stood up against the caste system. This is a story about how all these social barriers can be overcome if you have willingness to work hard, if you have burning desire, and if you are prepared to do the necessary sacrifices. It is possible to come above the caste barriers and carve out a life for yourself.
Mm.
I think that is a positive spin, positive story. So this is not a story which complains or blames the rest of the system. This is a story which says that you can beat the system if you try hard enough, mm-hmm. and that there is no need to exaggerate the impeding qualities or innate qualities of the system which try to hold you back.
Why don't we talk with a couple of listeners now?
Sure, why not?
Let's go first to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello?
Hello there.
Yes. Have you studied, it's what seems strikingly similar to what was considered a caste or apartheid system in the southern United States before de jure segregation was struck down.
Right.
And are there striking similarities between the caste system in India and the caste system there? And even though India has abolished its caste system,
right,
the impression I get is it still is institutionalized in the minds of people.
Right.
I would submit, as an African American who grew up in the southern part of the country, that still holds true in that part of the country as well. Have mm-hmm. you studied the comparisons between those two systems?
Well,
or are they similar? I know. I mean, I'm trying to see what the genesis of your caste system is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to compare that with the genesis of the racist system against African Americans in the United States, more specifically, the southern United States.
Right. No, I appreciate your comments, and I see some similarities. I'm not an expert on the struggle in United States, but some obvious similarities and differences that I see I would like to mention some of those. First of all, this is the segregation here, as I understand, is based on color in terms of race and color. In India, they are all the same people. There is no physical difference. But they were divided into various groups because a very small section of the society wanted to keep all the power, authority with them and treat the entire rest of the system to hold them onto ransom. And this was done for 2,000 years. They did not have, the majority of these people did not have access to education. Do you know what was the punishment given? If somebody some untouchable had audacity to recite the religious books, the Vedas, do you know the punishment was to cut his tongue? If he had audacity to listen to some Vedas,
mm-hmm.
do you know what was the punishment given?
No, I don't.
To pour molten lead in his ears.
Mm.
You know, those kind of things I don't think ever happened in the United States. Here, there's a large mass which was systematically denied any possible opportunity. They were kept ignorant. They were kept illiterate. So the small priestly class would write the big books, interpret the big books to their advantage, and hold everybody else subservient to them. And this went on for 2,500 years or even longer.
Well,
I don't. Sorry,
246 years where there was official slavery. We had similar attempts to deny opportunities.
Right.
My last question. I'm going to be quick because a part of the social justice movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
was grounded on that of Mahatma Gandhi.
Right.
And I want to know what stance did Mahatma Gandhi take against the caste system of India?
Well, you will be surprised. Of course, Mahatma Gandhi was our national leader, and he is the one leader who organized this 400 million people to stand up against the foreign rule. But I'm afraid, Mahatma Gandhi, in a way, was actually justifying the caste system. He did not challenge the social system. He mobilized, and he was the general, he was the commander-in-chief, who had great command over the Indian masses, and he rallied the masses around against the British power. But he did not challenge the social system. In fact, the person who challenged the social system, the person who challenged the caste system, was his contemporary and adversary, Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. Did take something from Mahatma Gandhi in terms of the civil disobedience, but those were the instruments of showing the unrest, you know, organizing the unrest. That is what I believe he took. But at the same time, there is another thing that happened much later. Do you know that in India, in Maharashtra, there was a movement called Dalit Panthers, which was modeled after the Black Panthers in the United States.
Oh.
So there has been a kind of loose connectivity between these two social movements.
Yeah. I've got a number of other listeners waiting to talk with us, but just a real quick question here.
Sure.
Why doesn't someone like myself know about Dr. Ambedkar?
Why doesn't one? Because
yeah.
It's part of that big scam. I can tell you that. No, honestly,
yeah.
I'm aware that this is a strong statement. Let me give you an example. Do you know that Dr. Ambedkar was the one who, it's an incredible achievement, he was the most highly educated economist in my country. He became later on Thomas Jefferson of India. He wrote the Constitution of India. But in 1915, he did his master's in economics in Columbia University in the United States. In 1917, he did his PhD in economics in Columbia University. In 1921, he did the Doctor of Science in economics in London School of Economics. That made him the most highly educated Indian in economics. And do you know that until 1991, he was not mentioned, his name was never mentioned in any book on history of economic thought in India. Nowhere there was a mention. One book had a mention in the footnote. Every small Tom, Dick, and Harry who did anything in economics finds a mention in those books, but not Dr. Ambedkar. You know, this is what makes one feel that there was some kind of big scam behind it, a conspiracy behind it. And I'm very happy to tell you, the very first book I wrote in my life was a book on economic thoughts and philosophy of Dr. Ambedkar. I wrote that in 1991 in English as well as in Marathi, and that was my personal tribute to this great man on his birth centenary.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener.
Sure.
Someone is listening to us this afternoon on the internet in Georgia and has called in, and they're waiting to talk with us on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm originally from India, and I would like to first congratulate Dr. Jadhav for his achievements and wonderful book. In terms of some of the things, sir, you pointed out.
Yeah.
I have my origins in a village in southern India, in Tamil Nadu.
All right.
And I've seen the discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
From the other point of view, being some people from my own community have perpetrated some heinous acts.
Right.
But in terms of the hierarchy, it's not just one small group, is it? I mean, what I'm trying to say is there are all these separate, you have castes which may be oppressed by one group, but they in turn turn around and become oppressors of the other group. So it's
very
not
true.
Just a clear black and white setting.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing I quickly want to point out is, with respect to Babasaheb Ambedkar, maybe his economics contribution, was not brought out. But in terms of our schooling, at least from my point of view, I've studied in various schools in India, and if you ask any school kid who is the father of the Indian Constitution, even in their sleep, they will say it's Babasaheb.
Absolutely.
And it's
right.
Maybe it's not deserved, gotten his deserved place in terms of economics, but at least in terms of his contribution to Indian national movement is
right. Two comments on both comments. Thank you very much for both of your comments, and I want to say a few words about both of them. One is that you're absolutely right that it was not only a small minority ruling all the rest. It was, as I mentioned earlier, it was a very complicated, intricate kind of system. It can be described as a system of graded inequality. There is a caste and subcaste, and the whole thing is in a hierarchical order. The one which is at the top of the hierarchy is the small class, which has designed it and helped perpetuate that for their own maintaining their own hegemony. And there is no doubt about that. Now, even among untouchables, there are hundreds of castes among untouchables, and those castes are also graded. It's mind-boggling that an untouchable caste thinks of another untouchable caste as below it. Now, what is the meaning of below and above at that level when you are treated worse than cats and dogs? This is the hierarchy that was created. These divisions were created so that there should not be a mass revolt against a small minority sitting at the top and taking all the gains, taking all the advantage. Coming to the second point, you are absolutely right that anybody would admit that Dr. Ambedkar, even in sleep, they would say that they recognize him as the architect of the Indian Constitution. But please remember that even there, in the last few years, there was an attempt made. I don't know whether you have heard of a book called Worshipping False Gods, where a systematic attempt has been made to demonstrate that he never wrote the Constitution, and the Constitution was written by somebody else. And that became a very controversial book. But, it is not that it is as widely accepted easily, because this is so deep-rooted in the mindset of the people. I would also like to tell you about an incident which is mentioned in the book about the first meeting between Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Ambedkar. And it's an eye-opener. The meeting did not go too well, but after the meeting was over, Mahadev Desai, who was the secretary of Mahatma Gandhi, told Mahatmaji that he should have handled Ambedkar a little carefully, because he said, he's a Dalit leader, an emerging Dalit leader, you should have handled him carefully. And Mahatma Gandhi, remember, no less than Mahatma Gandhi, he said, I cannot believe that he is a Dalit. He has to be a benevolent Brahmin. So he is the top class, but he is benevolent in nature, and therefore he is working for Dalits. How can such an intelligent person be Dalit? Now, if a man who reaches the stage of Mahatma, that is a great noble soul, cannot believe that untouchables can be extraordinarily intelligent, one can imagine how deep-rooted this whole caste system has been into the mindset of people.
Hmm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Okay.
Sorry to say.
Uh-huh.
I would love to talk with you for another hour, but alas, we can't do that. I want to thank you for spending the time that you have spent with us this afternoon. It's just been a pleasure speaking with you.
Same here. Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you, Salset Queen. I really enjoyed it myself, and this dialogue will continue in different forms.
Very good. Narendra Jadhav has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Untouchables, My Family's Triumphant Journey Out of the Caste System in Modern India. It is available now in the United States, published by Scribner. In that interview from the archives, recorded on October 13th of 2005. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. It is 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Celeste, all red at the Chicago Board of Trade. That means futures were lower across the board in the grains and the oil seeds. Futures in the soybeans were down anywhere between 4 and 5 cents for the day. The corn futures were off about 4, and the wheat taking the heaviest losses in Chicago. September contract was down 9 cents today, with the settlement price at $3.84 a bushel. Their high price at $3.90, the low at $3.82 3/4 for the lead option September's. Once again, a settlement price there at $3.84, and they were off 9 for the day. December futures, 410.5, the high, the low at $4.03. Soft red winter wheat September's, or rather December, settled at $4.05 1/4. They were off 8.5 cents. And the March contract down 9.5 today at $4.22 3/4, with a high price of $4.27.5 and a low at $4.21. The May futures, $4.36, the high, the low at $4.30, settlement price at $4.32, down 9.5 cents. In July contract, the harvest month, $4.43.5, the high, the low at $4.36. Their settlement price at $4.39. They were off 7.5 cents for the day. I don't think I gave you the high and low for that December contract. On the nearby high of 4.10.5 and a low at 4.03. Once again, it settled at 4.05 1/4, and it was off 8.5 cents for the D soft red winter wheat in Chicago. Checking in on the other wheat exchanges from Kansas City, the September contract settling at 4.69 3/4. They were off 14.75 for the day. And the Minneapolis Grain Exchange spring wheat settled at 4.71 1/4 in the September contract. It was down 9.5 cents. Corn pit now, September futures, 2.38 1/4 in Chicago on the high, the low at 35. Settlement price 3/4 above that at $2.35 3/4 for the September corn. It finished off 4 cents for the day. December futures were down 4 at 2.53 with a high of 55.5 and a low at 52. And the March contract is 2.69 3/4 high, low at 2.66 1/4. Settlement price there at 2.67 1/4. And they finished down 4 cents as well. May futures were off 4 as well, 2.76 1/4 the settlement price, the high at 78.5 and the low at 75.25. July futures in the corn pit, 2.87.5 from Chicago on the high, ranging down to 2.84, settlement price at 2.85 1/4. For the July corn, down 4.25 cents a bushel, and the September's for next year, 2.94 the high, the low at 91, settlement price at $2.92.5. They were off 4.5 cents. December 2007 corn contract, $3.04 the high, the low at $3 even. Settlement price at $3.01 1/4, down 4 3/4. And the March corn, $3.13 the high, the low at $3.11. Settlement price at $3.11.5. They finished 4.5 cents lower on the day. September oats at $1.81.5. Settlement price, they were up a half, $1.81 3/4 the high, the low at $1.78.5. Once again, the September oat contract, I missed that one. It was the only gainer at the Chicago Board of Trade in the list that we have, up a half cent at $1.81.5 in the SEP oats. December futures, $1.88.5, and they were down 3/4 for the day. August soybean futures in the oil seeds now, $5.63.5 the high, low at $5.55, settlement price at $5.57.5, off 5 3/4 for the August beans. September futures were down 4 3/4 cents at $5.62.5 a bushel, the low at $5.60, the high at $5.68 3/4. November soybeans, $5.82 3/4 the high, the low at $5.73.5, a settlement price there at $5.76 1/4.